Well, Trump hate goes local. Las Cruces officials voting on measure opposing border wall. And this is from the Albuquerque Journal, and you just heard it in the local news. Las Cruces City Council scheduled a vote Tuesday on a resolution in opposition of President Donald Trump's plan to build the wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. And Mayor Pro Tem Greg Smith contending that the border wall would harm the area's economy by hurting the relationship with Mexico. And so, by the way, the term mayor pro tempore or deputy mayor pro tem, assuming mayoral duties in the event of a mayor's absence due to death, physical incapacity, impeachment, and the Latin term pro tempore, meaning for the time being. So the assignment is always temporary. And so that's how Greg Smith got that designation. And he was also going to ask, or the city council is going to ask, federal authorities to find a more effective way to address concerns over illegal immigration. And the wall is part of a larger effort by the president to toughen up immigration, and currently 700 miles of pedestrian fencing and vehicle barriers exist along the 2,000-mile border between Mexico and the United States. I mean, if that's how he feels, city council feels, why don't they put in a measure to demand that 700 miles of border be taken down? I mean, if it's harming a relationship with Mexico, and if the most important thing that exists is our relationship with Mexico over every other concern, why not ask for that, and just to show that we're good-hearted, or whatever the idea would be, you know, I mean, for God's sakes. But you know, I was talking to somebody yesterday about the relationship between the United States and Mexico, and how people are treated in Mexico. And he said it's absolutely astounding how people are treated who sneak into Mexico, and the difference in the laws, and it's funny that at the same time, you know, one of the funny things is the way the media works. It would be a lot more interesting world if the media, I would say, you know, anybody can say if the media did its job, which is kind of a throwaway phrase, but what if the media told the whole story? The reason there's the corruption and the hilarity over them, the rage of the media against the president is because they have done a partial job for so long that people have forgotten what it would be like to have a media that really did the story. What if they, and when they were doing stories like this, they would actually go and say, well, you know, the Mexico's upset because we want to put this wall up. And so why is Mexico upset? Because we, you know, why would putting up a wall create hard feelings? I mean, what if you had a neighbor who you told them you're going to put a wall up? They had a dog or whatever. They kept getting into your yard, or their kids were wandering over and, you know, kind of uprooting the flowers or trampling the garden, whatever, having parties in your backyard. And how would you feel if your neighbor was upset because you wanted to put up a wall because there were people that were coming from their yard into your yard? I mean, that would be seen as ridiculous, right? I mean, that would be kind of an absurd thing. So if the media in our country were to say, well, they're upset, but the reason they're upset is because, you know, their economy is bad, and they can't provide all the jobs that are necessary for their own people. And so their people go into your, which everybody knows, their people go into your country illegally to work, which, you know, then the media could say, well, that benefits America and everything. Kind of a two-way street. But, you know, what if they also put in there other facts, like, for instance, the idea that there's a certain amount of crime and there's this and that, and that Mexico, the crime rate decreases in Mexico, for instance, if there's no border wall, because certain percentage of criminals come over to America. Now, if you told somebody that, they would get upset, whether it was true or not, and the person was liberal, they would be upset because it's an unfair thing to say, according to the theory that, you know, what the purpose of America is to do these great extraordinary works of charity and all these different things, to be kind of a sponge for the world's poor or whatever. But just the idea of putting up a wall to protect yourself or to escape from the kind of treatment that most people don't want, if the media were to do something like that, there would be obviously probably a pretty quick rise in the support of the wall. But that doesn't happen. And the reason it doesn't happen, and the reason that what Trump is saying at some level against the media is fundamentally true, is because the media has been doing a partial job for so long that they've convinced themselves that they are doing the truth. And so the truth to the media is basically doing part of the job as an advocate. So they're advocating, but what are they advocating for? So you see right away that they're really not, they're not doing a job of reporting, because they're busy doing advocacy. Now you can say that's the way it should be or has to be. You can make arguments to suggest that if we don't do it that way, then some evil will happen, right? But you can't say, generally speaking, that they're doing an unbiased job, because they're not. The only question is whether you accept the idea of bias. Is there such a thing as bias? If you're a socialist, probably there is no such thing as bias, because there is no such thing as there's no such thing as the truth or a lie, because you've rejected religion and morality and ethics and everything. I'm being serious about this. I'm not trying to piss anybody off who is not conservative or whatever. So, you know, if you deal with things from that angle, then you would have to say, okay, so let's just say you're a liberal, you don't believe that there is such a thing as bias. There is, on the other hand, there is what Hillary Clinton wrote her, I think the name of her thesis about Saul Alinsky, the guy we talked about, I believe, yesterday for a little while, was there is only the fight. So think about it from that perspective. You know, Hillary Clinton is a very far left person, farther left than most people would realize. There is only the fight. So think about it from that angle. If there was only the fight, people are doing is right, correct? So let me put on a clip of how illegals are treated going into Mexico to honor Greg Smith's thesis. And I think this is a broad problem in America that is caused in part by the fact that we are the world's preeminently most powerful and influential society. So we tend to hear things from our own perspective, because there's this enormous amount of media that's put out there. Now, if you were in another country, you might think about things a little bit differently. If you're in Mexico, I mean, I'm sure that a lot of Mexican people, even if they're not highly educated, who are coming here illegally, know the truth, you know, and they come in, and if they pick up the liberal attitude and get outraged at the idea that you're trying to keep them out of the country and that you would build a wall, at the same time, they would know deep down that it's probably not an evil thing. And they pick up the liberal attitude because it benefits them. If they get outraged, if they pretend to feel aggrieved over the fact that someone would try to keep them from entering illegally into their country, if they pick up that liberal attitude, it's because it's part of the game. You come over from another country and act like you have rights in somebody else's country the second you step there. Like you're entering heaven or something. So anyway, how are illegals treated going into Mexico? Here's a little bit from Tucker Carlson.
Signaled that it does plan to move forward with Trump's immigration agenda, which he has outlined, with a focus on first removing criminal illegal aliens from the country. And apparently a wall, that much promised wall, is on the way. During today's White House news conference, Press Secretary Sean Spicer had this to say.
I think the president has noted that this was a serious priority of his throughout the campaign. He has already started to work with Congress on the appropriations avenue of that. And so he is doing everything he can to direct agencies and Congress to commence with that work as soon as possible.
We're joined now from San Diego by Enrique Moronis. He's founder of the pro-immigrant group Border Angels and a fierce critic of Trump's immigration plan. Enrique, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Sure. Glad to be here.
So I've read a lot about your views on this, and they're pretty conventional on the left. You think that his immigration plans are wrong and mean and immoral, and you've described him as a racist. What's interesting, though, about you is that you are not just a citizen of the U.S., but a citizen of Mexico. In fact, you describe yourself in your bio as a proud American, but I'm quoting now, but an even prouder Mexican. So I think it's fair to ask you this question. If you think that Trump's border security plans are immoral, what do you make of Mexico's border laws, which are much tougher than anything President Trump has suggested?
Well, I'm in the majority of people's opinions about Donald Trump, and I think it is very inhumane, you know, to build a wall. The wall that exists right now between the United States and Mexico covers a third of the border and has led to more than 11,000 deaths. As you know, there's no wall with Mexico and Guatemala. They do have strict laws, just like the United States has strict laws. They don't have a deportation police like Donald Trump wants to have. They don't have people rounding up and raiding people and not allowing people to come in because of their religion or the country they come from, like Trump wants to do.
Huh.
So what Donald Trump has said, stated, and has lived by are very, very racist, very xenophobic lifestyle and his messages. And it's a very, very sad state of affairs. And I travel quite a bit. And it's really an embarrassment to the whole world to have Donald Trump.
Well, you must not travel much to Mexico because they do have a deportation force. Okay, well, then you should pay closer attention to what they're doing on the southern border. They not only control the border, but really, okay. Well,
no.
What percentage do you think of clemency requests they grant? Someone comes into Mexico from Guatemala or Salvador or Honduras and says, I need amnesty, I would like to stay. In the U.S., we grant about 50% of those. How many do you think Mexico grants?
The U.S. grants about 4%. The U.S. grants about 4%.
No, that's actually
Mexico,
49. That's 49. It's 49%.
No.
Just for your information.
Well,
Tucker,
just for a second, I just realized there's Fox and there's facts. For a moment, I forgot I was on Fox. But as far as Mexico is concerned, you can go down to – this is what I do every day.
Uh-huh.
When you go to Mexico, the reason you have a lot of asylum seekers going through Mexico is because you get a 21-day pass. They go from southern Mexico to northern Mexico. They apply for asylum on the Tijuana border or the Mexicali border, northern cities of Mexico. Most are turned away by the United States. They're allowed to come in. They don't have a family relative, and then they're deported. And this is something that a lot of people don't realize.
Okay, so let's get fact-based, okay? So in Mexico, illegal immigration is a felony in Mexico, punishable by up to 2 years in prison. Repeated attempts can get you 10 years in prison. People who aid illegal aliens in Mexico are also subject to felony charges. None of that is true in the United States. Mexican law says that Mexico can deport illegal aliens, quote, who are detrimental to economic or national interests, who violate Mexican law, or, and I'm quoting now, who are not physically or mentally healthy or lack the means to sustain themselves. Are those humane laws? Are those racist laws?
U.S. has laws like that, and they're not illegal aliens. They're undocumented people.
Actually,
and there's 250 million undocumented people in the world. In the world.
Federal
U.S. only has 11
describes
million.
Them as, oh, hold on, just since you're so knowledgeable, our federal documents, the IRS, for example, describes people who are in this country illegally as illegal aliens. So it's not some racist term I'm throwing around. It's a term that the Obama administration used for 8 years. So let's just
but the
stop
thing
with,
is before they were called wetbacks, people were called three-fifths of a human being.
I'm using
the terminology.
First of all, they were never called three-fifths of a human being by anybody. By anybody. I don't know where you're conflating two things. But you're not answering my question, which is, in Mexico, it is a felony to go into Mexico illegally. And I'm not here to beat up a Mexico. I'm merely saying, as someone who says that he's more proud to be Mexican than American and is holding the U.S. to this standard, why don't you answer the question? Do you agree with the fact it's a felony to go into Mexico illegally?
No. And the thing is that I never said I'm more proud to be Mexican than the United States of America. I'm a
it
dual
says
national.
Right here, I'm reading your
countries.
Bio. Your bio, which I read about 4 minutes ago, said, quote, I'm a proud American and an even
I'm very
prouder
proud to
Mexican.
Be American and to be Mexican.
Even
and
prouder
doesn't say
to be Mexican
but
than
I don't
American.
Know which bio
you
you're reading,
in,
but I'm very proud of my Mexican
border
heritage.
Angel
sex, very
which
proud.
I just read.
Yeah.
Okay. But, so my question
very
is,
proud.
If you're even prouder to be Mexican than you are to be American, then clearly your main interest is in preserving the well-being of that country, because you just said, I'm prouder to be Mexican than to be American. So that's fine.
I didn't say that, but the thing
that.
Is that,
it
that both
right
countries
your bio,
are great.
I don't want to debate something
if more,
that's true.
I think I know the way I feel and what I say. I know. I don't know what you say. You know.
Okay. Well,
and I'm telling you, I love
either.
Both countries. I love both countries.
Whatever.
If more people have the dual nationality, like a lot of countries have, then you can be treating people with dignity and respect, building bridges, not walls. 11,000 deaths
nobody
of
is
migrants
against,
because of the wall?
Nobody is against treating people with dignity, and I'm not
well,
here
Donald Trump.
All right, I've got a little bit more here because I want to make a point. There is the grandstanding of American liberals on these subjects. It's sad. It really is. Makes me sad. And Greg Smith's a nice guy. If you've met him, nice guy, down to earth and everything. Maybe he's become big headed since the last time I talked to him, like a lot of these politicians do. But yeah, I mean, he's essentially a good guy. But, I think it's sad that the left always has to commit itself to do things that make Americans look bad. That the left has always got to show how hypocritical and selfish and greedy we are. And, the purpose of the left is to debase and degrade and put America at a disadvantage. Why is that? Well, from what I can see is that, moral posturing must feel wonderful, It must feel great to turn around to the people that you live with and tell them how bad and selfish they are and how wrongheaded they are. And on the other hand, this socialist paradise, this global utopia that they want to build, I mean, I don't know. It's just it is kind of disheartening to see that there's no end to the moral superiority of leftism, that it's done in a manner to debase and discredit other people. And this idea that, liberals are better than other people, and add in there that they're fact-free, that the vast majority of these people who grandstand, who are liberals, don't have a factual basis. How can you attack America wanting to build a wall if you don't, explain how Mexico treats people that come in? Maybe Mexico doesn't put in a wall because nobody wants to go there, because the way they treat people who come in illegally is so harsh that nobody would ever consider it. And maybe Mexico is opposed to the wall because it basically does what the country can't do for itself. It makes Mexico better by deporting a lot of poor people and uneducated and criminal individuals who come into a bigger and stronger economy and make money and send it back to Mexico. Why would they want to put up a wall? But if putting up a wall harmed the relationship between America and Mexico, what does that say about Mexico? What does it say about a country that says to another country, you can't put up a barrier to keep our people from illegally entering? That's insane if you look at it on its face, And it just goes to show you the lawlessness that's in the mind of these liberals. There is no such thing as a law. It doesn't matter if it is harmful to the views of the liberal. So anyway, that's what I think about this. Number one. Number two, the president ran on this as a promise. Now, here's a little bit more on this. Mexican President Calderon admits Mexican immigration laws are tougher than Arizona's immigration laws. And this is from CNN in 2010.
Mexico's laws. I read an article in the Washington Times the other day. I'm going to read a paragraph to you, and you tell me if this is true or not true. This is from the Washington Times. Under the Mexican law, illegal immigration is a felony punishable by up to 2 years in prison. Immigrants who are deported and attempt to re-enter can be imprisoned for 10 years. Visa violators can be sentenced to six-year terms. Mexicans who help illegal immigrants are considered criminals. Is that true?
It was true, but it's not anymore. We derogate or we erase that part of the law. Actually, illegal immigration is not a crime in Mexico, not anymore, since 1 year ago. And that is the reason why we are trying to establish our own comprehensive public policy talking about, for instance, immigrants coming from Central America. In particular,
so people want to come from Guatemala or Honduras or El Salvador or Nicaragua. They want to just come into Mexico. They can just walk in?
No, they need to fulfill a form. They need to establish their right name. We analyze if they have not criminal precedent.
What they were called,
and they keep coming into Mexico. Actually,
do Mexican police go around asking for papers of people they suspect are illegal immigrants?
Of course, in the border, we're asking the people, who are you? And if they explain...
At the border, I understand when they come in, but
yes,
once they're in...
But not in... Once they are inside the country, what the Mexican police do is, of course, enforce the law, but by any means, immigration is a crime anymore in Mexico.
Immigration is not a crime.
It's not a crime.
So in other words, if somebody sneaks in from Nicaragua or some other country in Central America through the southern border of Mexico, they wind up in Mexico, they can go get a job, they can work.
If somebody do that without permissions, we send back them.
Well, I think it's a little more than sending them back. I mean, a lot of these people are beaten up and thrown in jail, and I don't, you know, the guy said immigration law has been irrigated. I mean, that would suggest to me that it's not enforced, but we know that it is enforced. So here's a little bit more on that. Let's see here. Let me hold on a second here. I've got a little bit more, but here's the thing. I mean, I don't believe this Mexican president. This guy's not in office anymore. But I don't really. Listening to this guy talk, there's nothing in what he's saying that really I would put my faith into. I'd want to know if they suddenly changed their law, why. Why is nobody talking about it? But anyway, going into Mexico illegally, you're going to risk much harsher treatment than you are going to get here. So, but I just need to ask. I mean, what are we gaining by having this permanent kind of idea that what do leftist progressives? Almost every person that I've ever met who has claimed to be a liberal, when I talk to them and I ask them they're a socialist, and they get this shocked look on their face, no, I'm not a socialist. And then I ask them all of the elements of socialism, and they end up agreeing that they do support those things. 641 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523 1450. And I unearthed the text machine, which has now got a million texts on it. We'll be right back. A little bit of lion eyes for these lion politicians.
City girl just seemed to find out early how to open doors with just a smile. A rich old man, she won't have to worry. She'll dress up all in lace, go inside.
right. So, you know, I don't want to get into this too deep because everybody knows what's going on, but you've got, yeah, I mean, there's always going to be in history, Abraham Lincoln talked about, there's always some demon, there's always some great fight that's going on. Each age has its evil, and obviously in Lincoln's time, it was slavery. And in our time, you know, I'm sure that abortion would fit in there, and future generations may look back and say that, that how could we knowingly and with a great deal of enthusiasm, especially females, celebrate the idea of killing unborn human beings for whatever, you know, to use as birth control or population or convenience or whatever. And, you know, so I think another evil that is going to go that it may last, who knows? I mean, the future might be socialism, but if the future is socialism, the world will be a giant prison cell, because to enforce socialism, which is not a natural human activity, not a natural human state, they're going to have to enforce it. They're going to enforce socialism through the means that they are able to use, which is, I mean, let's face it, the way that you would do it is to do what they're doing right now, slowly taking away the rights and privileges of people to fit us into this new idea. I'm amazed at the number of politicians and elites who have talked about this new world order that we're now destroying. What new world order? You know, if human beings have not changed, from what my understanding is, there really is no change in human beings based on the literature that was written thousands of years ago, 2,000 years ago. The literature was things that were written that are considered to be classics still appeal to people because we still have the same minds. We still have the same human nature. So, all right. Just a little bit more on this. The UK Guardian reported that immigration activists say that Mexico's National Institute of Migration, Instituto Nacional de Migración in Spanish, is conducting itself like an unchecked police force that is systematically using torture against detainees. And that's what this guy, this president of Mexico, no longer in office, didn't point out, is that Mexico is much less a place of the rule of law. So it doesn't really matter as much what the law is as it would here. It's reported that, and this is from Breitbart, but it's taken from The Guardian, from a report in the UK Guardian, Mexicans are being detained and threatened with deportation as a result of an effort to crack down on illegal immigrants coming from Central America. What if you're a poor country and you have a lot of poor people in it, by definition? Those people are trying to leave to go to another country that's richer, and then you have a country underneath you or next to you that's even poorer, and those people are pouring in. That's going to be a total crisis for you. So how do they deal with it? Well, the United Nations reporter, Juan Menzies, was writing about torture. He presented a report to the UN in 2015 in March. That's 5 years after the president of Mexico said the laws had all been changed. He toured Mexico and said that there were beatings, electric shocks, suffocation, waterboarding, forced nudity, and rape, as well as threats and insults. And so don't forget the degree that the illegal cartels were, which are still hugely, hugely influential and in control of Mexico. For those guys to come over here and give us a lecture about the rule of law is astounding, and how we don't treat people well. How does Mexico allow its citizens to be treated by the cartel, you know? I do understand that people want to leave Mexico because it's not safe, but that is not an answer to America. It's a problem. Now, there's a gentleman that they talked to Mexico. 18-year-old Alberto reported by The Guardian to have been placed in a room with four agents. He's from Central America. Placed in a room with four agents where he was tortured. He was allegedly told that unless he signed paperwork admitting he was Guatemalan, he would be killed. He was quoted as saying, "One pushed me, another was kicking my leg, and a third was a very fat guy who gave me an electric shock on the back of my right hand. He said, I thought I was going to die." His two sisters were traveling on a bus, 15 and 24, Esther and Amy. And so the girls were reportedly told they were going to be deported back to Guatemala. All right, so we've already been told that a very, very high number, high percentage of women who travel through Mexico are raped. Who's doing the raping? I mean, is it not obviously the government? Somebody in the government is at least some of the rapists? I mean, if Mexico is not an entire country of rapists, which I have to assume it's not, then that means that the rapists are probably have some sort of prominent position where they are coming into contact with these people, these women, and they're able to rape them. So anyway, for these people to lecture us on how we should act towards their people is absurd. I think I made my point. Kelly O'Connell, AM, Las Cruces, AM 1450. Here's a little bit of weather for you.
Late at night, a big old house gets lonely. I guess every form of refuge has its price. And it breaks her heart to think her love is only given to a man with hands as cold as ice.
All right, so we've got I've got a clip of Mexican President Calderon on Arizona immigration before the U.S. Congress. I'm going to play that for you first in a minute. But first, I want to read for you from the Daily Kos, a very liberal site that says the Mexican Constitution forbids non-citizens to participate in the country's political life. Non-citizens are forbidden to participate in demonstrations or express opinions in public about domestic politics. Article 9 states, quote, only citizens of the Republic may do so to take part in the political affairs of the country. Article 33 is unambiguous. Foreigners may not in any way participate in the political affairs of the country. Denies fundamental property rights to foreigners. If foreigners wish to have certain property rights, they must renounce the protection of their own governments or risk confiscation. Foreigners are forbidden to own land in Mexico within 100 kilometers of land borders or within 50 kilometers of the coast. Actually, it's very hard to buy stuff down there. I had researched this before. Article 27, only Mexicans by birth or naturalization of Mexican companies have the right to acquire ownership of lands, waters, and their appurtenances or to obtain concessions for the exploitation of mines and waters. I could go on and on. If outsiders, and this is from another article, Mexican government will bar foreigners if they upset, quote, the equilibrium of the national demographics. If outsiders do not enhance the country's economic or national interests or are not found to be physically or mentally healthy, they are not welcome. Neither are those who show contempt against national sovereignty or security. What if we applied these rules to the people coming in? Are you freaking kidding me? Greg Smith is getting up and lecturing on the wall here. Illegal entry in the country is equivalent to a felony punishable by 2 years. Law enforcement officials at all levels by national mandate must cooperate to enforce immigration laws, including illegal alien arrests and deportation. So here is Calderon lecturing the United States from our Congress on how bad Arizona is.
However, I strongly disagree with the recently adopted law in Arizona. It is a law.
He's saying Arizona.
It is a law that not only ignores a reality that cannot be erased by decree, but also introduces a terrible idea using racial profiling as a basis for law enforcement. And that is why I agree with President who said the new law carries a great amount of risk when core values that we all care about are breached. I don't want to deep the gap between the feelings and emotions between our countries and our people.
So they'll let this guy come in and attack the sovereignty of Arizona, the ability to make their own laws, and then everybody gets up and cheers, and their country is a disaster. Fix your own damned country before you start lecturing us on how we're supposed to treat your people. When we treat your pet people in our country who are illegals better than you treat your own citizens, let alone immigrants or illegal immigrants, that's pretty dang sick. We'll be back after a break on the hour. Kelly O'Connell.
So she tells him she must go out for the evening to comfort an old friend who's feeling down. But he knows where she's going and she's leaving. She is headed for the cheating side of town. You can't hide, you're lying eyes. And your smile and the sense is gone. I thought by now you'd realize.
No way. All right, so we've got, I'm just looking at the weather for California, and they were talking about a storm that would come in and dump more than, oh, well, it would be over 100 mile an hour winds, and that would mean over the mountains higher than that. So we've got sinkholes that have come up in the middle of nowhere, and they were talking about this atmospheric river. Hold on, I'm trying to multitask here. So let me see. Let me get a little bit of this stuff going for you. There was other breaches of dams. It wasn't just Oroville that was worrying. They were getting other. Looking at all these clips, it's pretty amazing. Let me play you first a severe flooding in California clip from CBS.
This was the scene around Southern California Saturday. Uprooted trees piled on cars and buildings and muddy fields and highways. A man was electrocuted in this LA neighborhood when a tree fell on a power line and came crashing down.
Mother Nature came to strike.
The storm, packing winds of up to 80 miles per hour, began early Friday, quickly turning parking garages into waterfalls. Water rushing from the mountains triggered mudslides.
The drenching rains were too much for the roads to handle. This 20-foot sinkhole swallowed two cars.
There goes the car. There goes the car.
The driver was rescued before the second car fell in the massive hole. Flooded highways trapped drivers in rising waters. This man climbed through a window to escape. Another waited on the roof of his car for help. The driver in the car behind him was drowned. And air travel was at a standstill. The Santa Barbara airport was completely flooded. The storm forced hundreds of flight delays and cancellations through Saturday. Danielle Nottingham, CBS News, Los Angeles.
All right, and it's going on and on. Here is another clip from... Yeah, I'm looking at pictures of the Sacramento River. It's way, way over its banks. And, I mean, I think we skipped a bullet on Oroville with the possibility of going over the banks and then before the dam itself to come apart. But these guys got very, very lucky. And as I had mentioned, there was a lawsuit about 10 years ago trying to force them to put concrete on the side where the emergency spillway is. In the meanwhile, the main spillway has literally come apart in giant pieces. It's $200 million to fix it. And from what I understand, Trump is saying he doesn't plan on doing that. Here is from ABC7 from this morning.
Powerful storm is now slamming Northern California. You can see the circulation around that low, bringing tons of moisture onshore. Flash flood watches, heavy snow up in the Sierra. Now for us, just a little bit of rain will come through, some drizzle, as what's left of the weather system slides down into Southern California during the day. Then some partly cloudy skies on Wednesday. So for tomorrow, still kind of gloomy. We may see a little partial afternoon sunshine across the LA Basin during the afternoon. So let's go with about a 65. And then Wednesday, 62. And then some beautiful sunshine Thursday and Friday. So we're going to set up for a couple of great days. It's going to be chilly at night, no doubt about that. As a matter of fact, the valley temperatures by Thursday and Friday night will drop into the upper 30s. Today, just some drizzle or light rain. And then as we head toward the weekend, increasing clouds on Saturday. Right now, it looks like Oscar Sunday is going to have some clouds around, and we're going to have to deal with some showers at that time. In the beaches, we've got a swell for you out of the west and southwest. Kind of cloudy and then clearing Thursday and Friday. Beautiful weather Saturday and then some rain by Sunday and Monday. Mountains, you're going to get some snow, but not today. Partly cloudy, gusty winds in the mountain areas. Cold.
All right, so they dodged a bullet over there, but the amount of moisture that they've gotten is so gigantic. It's just unbelievable. I got two more clips for you, and then we'll take a little break. But what has happened in California to go from extreme drought in a couple of months to extreme flooding is just surreal. And the same thing happened to Texas. As you recall, Texas had 5 years of extreme drought, and that was wiped away in a month or two. And to this day, we're still getting flooding in Texas, in Houston, in the Metroplex, Dallas, Fort Worth, in Austin, and in San Antonio. And the night before last, I think there were 5 tornadoes in San Antonio. Here is a little more from the Weather Channel.
East of Modesto, California, the spillway gates of the Don Pedro Reservoir were open for the first time in 20 years. So many months as we saw snow, additional snow piling in across the Sierra. And, of course, there were mandatory evacuations ordered in parts of Central and Northern California on Monday as flooding, debris flow, wind damage reports kept on pouring in from the Bay Area to Monterey in California. There were also 2 people who died in a fatal accident in Modesto. We want to show you what's happening with California. We are starting to see a little bit of activity winding down. Thankfully, as we go through the afternoon, we'll start to get away from some of the wind. But in the last 24 hours, just look at all the flooding and the landslide reports that have occurred. Now, again, we're going to be slowing down just a little bit. The concern, of course, going forward is going to be the additional snow melt and the runoff that's happening. So we're still not out of the woods with that quite yet. Here's a look at the rain and snowfall forecast that is still going to be working in. Again, we're slowing down, starting to see some lighter amounts, but even those lighter amounts could possibly cause some problems.
All right, and here's one last part. The atmospheric rivers, also known as, from in this part of the world, the Pineapple Express, are creating an extraordinary phenomenon where the water, the atmosphere is so soaked with water that when it begins to rain, it has to flood. And here's a little bit on that from Watch It News.
A powerful Pacific storm blew into southern and central California on Friday with wind-driven heavy rains. According to the Associated Press, the storm triggered rescues and calls for evacuations. It also toppled trees and power lines and disrupted travel and outdoor events. With the storm feeding on an atmospheric river of moisture stretching far out into the Pacific, some neighborhoods were requested to evacuate as a precaution due to the potential for mudslides and debris flows. Numerous flights were delayed or canceled at the state's airports.
And people are going to end up blaming this on global warming. You know, it is the action of individuals who don't have any specific knowledge to a great deal of the areas that they're commenting on, that if everything is caused by global warming, you know, there's no details. You don't need any details, because if anything happens out of the ordinary, it's caused by global warming, because global warming causes or affects everything. We'll take a break here. Kelly O'Connell, 7:15 a.m. Las Cruces. We're going to get into the life of Jefferson a little bit as a celebration of President's Day, which was yesterday.
On the other side of town, a boy is waiting.
Let me get you some, and good morning if you're just tuning in, Kelly, and let me get you some headlines for you. And then I want to play a little clip on the deep state, an idea that has been put out there, and Glenn Greenwald has been talking about it, but it's an idea that's been around for quite a while, that there is a shadow government that exists within the bureaucracy that really has an enormous amount of influence on the government and decision making and upon society. All right, Congress is stalling Trump's agenda in the second month, and this is just in. RNC sets a record with $20 million January. So I think the people that voted for Trump are already of a mind to be independent thinkers, to look at the news with a great deal of skepticism, the amount of lying. And I told you I went to lunch and I got into an unexpected argument over fake news. Look, I mean, I've known since I was a kid there's fake news out there and it's pumped out by the media. I mean, that I as soon as I could understand words and started listening to the TV, I understood that there was fake news. I don't know how else to explain it. It was obvious, I guess because I grew up, my dad was fairly conservative, that people were not telling the truth in the media. It's something I just grew up with. The idea that this is shocking and needs to be apologized for and is itself a falsehood and is the creation of Donald Trump is absurd. Anybody who's from the center, and everybody knows this is true. It doesn't bother you if you're on the left because that's how you get power, is you falsify information or cook information. You shape it so that people are misinformed. Liberalism is based out, far leftism is based on a tissue of lies. And the only way to keep it propped up is to continue lying. All right. Now, Milo Yelanovich or whatever the guy's name is, Milo Yiannopoulos is in a lot of trouble because he stated something that was, I mean, look at the guy, he's a drama queen, he's a gay conservative. He's canceled from CPAC, which is the big meeting every year for conservatives. He got up in some video and talked about the safe space that's created by older men who are in contact with younger men and allowing them to talk about things that their parents wouldn't let them talk about. It was an apparent reference to pedophilia and child adult sex. And then he got up and admitted that he was abused as a child. And as I told you before, it's my theory, and it's been backed up by a lot of research and anecdotes, that gay people, to a large extent, maybe not as much as they used to be because it's become a movement unto itself, but gay people are abuse survivors. And so this guy sounds like, from what he said, he was raped when he was 13. And unfortunately, in a percent of these people that are sexually abused by the same sex as a child, that seems to reorient their orientation. I don't know what else to say. Here's some of your headlines. Teacher reassigned after praising Trump action on immigration. Last night in Sweden, and there's this big deal about Trump saying something about what was happening in Sweden. Sweden's got the highest rape rate in the world outside of some country in Africa. And it's all because of the Muslims that they brought in there. That's all there is. That's all you can say. Last night in Sweden, riots in migrant suburb. Loot fighting with police set car on fire. TSA is allowing some passengers to go through without being screened. That was an accident. U.S. official says ISIS has people in place to conduct steady attacks. Barcelona cops shoot at driver and vehicle packed with gas cylinders. Radiation spike in Europe sparks fear. Putin tested nuke in Arctic. Very mysterious. Record rains in San Francisco. Rivers and sky causing widespread chaos, as we already mentioned. The typical Venezuelan lost 19 pounds last year due to lack of food. More than 100 headstones vandalized in historic Jewish cemetery. Hillary is keeping her name out there, possibly to run again. Devil woman who suffocated cousin during exorcism is been jailed. Killer chimp gang hunts and eats monkey in bloody attack. David Cassidy, teen idol, is said to have dementia. Here is a little bit about the deep state, and this is from about a year ago from Rutherford Institute. They've talked about the deep state. It's not hard to understand. The people that are attacking right now against Trump are individuals. Many of them are individuals in the deep state, bureaucratic positions, hidden. There are supporters of Obama and his AFO, Organizing for Action. He's got 32,000 foot soldiers to go protest at any place in the world or any place in the country. And he's doing it, and that's where all these protests are coming from. Here we go, Rutherford Institute.
This is John W. Whitehead, author of Battlefield America, The War on the American People, bringing you a message about the state of our nation. One of the things I learned as a young lawyer walking in and out of Washington, D.C., and I've been working at it for 40 years, suing politicians in Washington, D.C., working with groups there. One of the things I was told by early congressmen and consultants is, John, you have to understand, Washington, D.C. is not really run by elected officials. It's run by bureaucrats, the contractors, the surveillance communities, the police agencies. And, of course, over the years, that's actually grown now to where you have the Department of Homeland Security, which came into being after 9/11, the massive NSA, CIA operations that are spying on everything Americans do. Nothing is private anymore. That's being realized. What we call the government Washington, D.C., is really not the government. In other words, when you vote and you elect someone, you're not really electing the government that runs things. There's a deeper government there. It's something which has been called the deep state or the shadow government. In fact, since the early days after World War II, there's been a continuity of government, which is called COG, of unelected officials who will supposedly take over the government and run it if the government breaks down, if there's a war, or some kind of catastrophe, an economic collapse, which many people are fearing now. This so-called continuity of government, again, not elected officials, we don't know who they are, will run the government. The problem as I see it, as I research this issue more and more, is that how they view us as the American citizens. In fact, I think they view us as cattle or very expendable. In fact, one of the most troubling things I've seen emerge, and this is all documented by stories in the mainstream media, Washington Post and others, are these so-called secret bunkers that are located around the United States for the so-called elite, the economic elite and government elite, to escape into in a time of crisis. These bunkers, strategically located around the nation's capital in key states, represent the who's who on the shadow government's payroll, with every department agency represented, from the Department of Education to the Trademark Office to the Small Business Administration to the National Archives. Nobody's overlooked. You have stenographers, the firefighters, everybody that they want to escape into these bunkers to protect the so-called elite. The federal relocation arc near Washington, D.C. will reportedly serve as the emergency bunker for every cabinet department and every government organization deemed essential. Site R, a 700,000-foot facility inside Raven Rock Mountain near Camp David, will serve as a backup Pentagon. Peters Mountain near Charlottesville, Virginia, is the likely site for the nation's domestic spies to hide out. And then there's the 600,000-square-foot complex inside Virginia's Mount Weather. It's expected to be the primary relocation site for the White House, the Supreme Court, and much of the executive branch. Incredibly, built inside of the mountain is a staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week facility. This self-contained facility contains, among other things, a hospital, a crematorium, a dining and recreational area, sleeping quarters, reservoirs of drinking and cooling water, an emergency power plant, a radio television studio, and a full-time police and fire department. There's even an office of presidency at the Mount Weather, which receives regularly top secret national information updates from all these secret agencies in the government. Wait a minute here. Think about that. Did you really know that? How many people know that? A few reporters have reported it. The Washington Post, as I said earlier, there's a reported on it. But most people don't realize the fact that there are probably, this is the estimation by people who studied it and media and journalists, about 50 of these bunkers spread throughout the United States. They're like shopping malls. And who are they for? They're not for you and me, the taxpayer, the people who pay the bill. Therefore, in case of an emergency, the elite, the money elite, will escape underground. In 2014, Princeton University, along with Northwestern University, did a study of two decades of policies passed in Washington, D.C., federal government policies. The conclusion they came to after 20 years of studying policies that the American voter has no input, virtually none. These professors concluded that we are run in this country. We are ruled by a moneyed elite, an oligarchy, they call it. Think about that for a second. And this oligarchy, where are they going to go if there's a catastrophe in the United States, a major terrorist attack, an invasion or whatever? They're going to go underground and hide. What happens to you or me, folks? Are they thinking about us? Obviously not. They're not telling us. I don't have the escape plan. When 9/11 happened, they said the line of limousines, this is a reporter reported this, outside of Mount Weather, escaping to the underground bunker, was 3 or 4 miles long. The elite was escaping. What was going to happen to us? This raises a real serious question. Why is the government so paranoid that they're worried that there's going to be a rebellion? Some people don't like this. You're going to see some people getting upset about this. They may want to get out in the streets. Did you realize, and most people don't realize this, that there is a database, the federal government actually admits this, of over 8 million names, that's as of several years ago, of people, dissidents, that will be rounded up in times of emergency. Wait a second. People who get upset, want to get out there and fight, we're already on a list to be taken away. And where to? People say there's no such thing as the internment camps. Well, as has been documented, George W. Bush, as president, gave the Halliburton Corporation $385 million to start building them. Did they spend the money or did they throw it away? Did they flush it down the toilet, folks? I think they probably spent it, but where are the internment camps? As I'm told by some former Secret Service agents, they're probably on military bases. So we could be rounded up. But are we going to be in those secret bunkers? No. What does this tell us about our so-called government, Washington, D.C.? Does it really represent us? Does it care about us? As the very insightful satirist George Carlin once said, what you have in Washington, D.C. is a club, and you ain't a member, folks. So what do we do here? What I'm telling people is, obviously we can't have a big impact in Washington, D.C., but folks, we can have an impact on the local level. You can get down to your city council meeting. You can get together with your friends. And this is going to take getting them off your butts and getting active and turning off those screen devices, occasionally anyway, getting together with your friends, picketing, getting on city councils, and sending a message to Washington, D.C. that we don't like this kind of stuff. You can send back the militarized equipment your police have, which will be used against you in times of emergency. You can do a lot of things, but you're going to have to get active. The clock is ticking. There are a lot of people saying there's an apocalypse coming. That may be true, but the people who run the government are going to escape the apocalypse. So get active, get in your government, and it's time to tell those people in Washington, D.C., hey, think about us once. We're paying the bill, folks, and we are the government. You're supposed to be representing us.
Very prominent guy, John Whitehead, runs the Rutherford Institute. Rutherford wrote the book called Lex Rex, The Law is King, and was one of the most extraordinary books ever written, and helped found the rule of law in America. I didn't know a lot of this stuff before I heard this thing. I'm just getting into the shadow government, the idea of the deep state, and we're going to be listening to some clips on that later. Next, though, we're going to get into the history of Thomas Jefferson, celebration of President's Day, 732, 733 AM, Las Cruces AM, 1450. 523-1450 and 805-6180 to text. We'll be right back.
She drives on through the night anticipating, cause he makes her feel the way she used to feel.
In honor of President's Day, a little bit about Thomas Jefferson, the main drafter, the third president and the main drafter of the Declaration of Independence and one of the greatest Americans in history, an absolutely brilliant man who supposedly wrote the Declaration of Independence off the top of his head because he knew the sources so well, including John Locke. Check him out here. PBS Presidents right here, clip.
Thomas Jefferson had a big part in two revolutions. Everyone knows the first. Tom took the lead on the Declaration of Independence in 1776 with all that good stuff about power residing with the people. The second one started when he won the 1800 election. Jefferson thought national government had gotten too big, and he wanted to hit the reset button. As the leader of the Democratic Republican Party, he had the buddies in Congress to do it. Jefferson cut the military to shrink the national debt, and he rolled back taxes and other laws signed by his predecessors. Tom was intellectually flexible. In 1803, France wanted to sell Louisiana. Technically, the government didn't have the power to buy or hold new land, but it was such a good deal that Jefferson did it anyway. Then he sent Lewis and Clark to explore it. That expanded the role of government, and a few years later, in his second term, he ignored the will of the people to impose an unpopular trade embargo against England and France. It almost wrecked the economy. Tom retired in 1809, and he died on July 4, 1826, within hours of John Adams. But his ideas about government dominated American politics for generations. That much is self-evident.
Okay, and now here's a little bit more. President Thomas Jefferson biography from the U.S. President site.
Thomas Jefferson was the third president of America and most famous as the author of the Declaration of Independence and for his negotiation of the Louisiana Purchase with France, which doubled the size of the United States. He was born on April 13, 1743, in Albemarle County, Virginia. He was named after his grandfather, Thomas Jefferson II, a prominent landowner, militia captain, and justice of Chesterfield County, Virginia. Thomas Jefferson was raised on a family farm to a wealthy family and enjoyed the company of his six sisters and three brothers. He died on July 4, 1826, in Monticello, in Virginia. The career of Thomas Jefferson included the roles of lawyer, politician, and statesman. He was such a good writer that he was one of five men chosen to write the Declaration of Independence. Johnson's library of approximately 6,000 books became the basis of the Library of Congress. He became the third U.S. president in 1801 and served for 8 years until 1809. His wife died 19 years before he became president, so there was no first lady. Thomas Jefferson married Martha Wales Skelton on New Year's Day in 1772. Martha died 12 years later. They had six children, but only two survived to adulthood. On her deathbed, Martha asked her husband to promise that he would never remarry. Thomas Jefferson kept his promise, which led to a 38-year relationship with his mixed-race slave, Sally Hemings, with whom he fathered six children. Thomas Jefferson belonged to the Democratic-Republican political party. He was 57 years old when he was inaugurated as the third president. Aaron Burr and George Clinton stood as vice presidents. During his presidency, he worked tirelessly to keep the United States out of the French-Napoleonic Wars. Thomas Jefferson was an imposing figure, standing at 6 feet, 2.5 inches. He owned slaves, which was common for men of his standing during his era. Thomas Jefferson initiated the custom of a president shaking hands, rather than bowing, to greet guests. His vibrant red hair turned sandy, then white, as he grew older. A 60-foot, 18-meter sculpture of his head is carved into Mount Rushmore as a monument to his many achievements. During his lifetime, he played a key role in major events of the era. Thomas Jefferson was instrumental in drafting the Declaration of Independence and during his presidency. He led the nation to victory in the Barbary Wars between the U.S. and North Africa's Barbary states and negotiated the Louisiana Purchase of 1803 with France, which doubled the size of the United States. During his life, Thomas Jefferson suffered from tuberculosis, an infectious bacterial disease that primarily affects the lungs. Tuberculosis was also known as consumption or the White Plague, reflecting the deadly nature of the disease, which was the cause of more deaths in America than any other during the 19th century. Thomas Jefferson died of natural causes, most likely dehydration, resulting from dysentery at the age of 84. His death occurred on July 4, 1826, in Monticello, in Virginia, and he was buried at the family estate in Charlottesville. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died within a few hours of each other on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, July 4, 1826. So ends our short biography about the life and presidency of Thomas Jefferson, the third president of America. He is most remembered as the author of the Declaration of Independence and for his negotiation of the Louisiana Purchase with France, which doubled the size of the United States. The next U.S. president was James Madison. This video is one of a series covering all of you.
All right, so here is, well, let's take a little break here and come back and get into him more. Got the Eagles for a 742 AM Los Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450, and 805 6180. Two text.
She rushes to his arms, they fall together. She whispers, it's only for a while. She swears that soon she'll be coming back forever.
Here is a little bit more on Jefferson. And I think the consensus is, I was just reading an article on this, the current consensus is that Jefferson did father the children with his slave. And that's, I mean, all you can do is be up to date on your understanding of the research. But disappointed a lot of people, and it was rejected by a lot of people. But, you know, great men have flaws. 7:45, and here is Thomas Jefferson writing the Declaration.
After nearly a year of war, the Americans still had not declared their independence from Great Britain. By John Adams' reckoning, only one-third of the colonists were for the rebellion. Another third were against it, and the remaining third were indifferent.
The image that the American Revolution was a spontaneous mass uprising of united souls who possibly from birth yearned to be an independent nation is not at all true. Far fewer people were willing to break with the king. Some didn't really feel that the revolution was merited.
Even within Congress, meeting at the Pennsylvania State House, some delegates still argued for mending the rift with England. But soon, the radicals pushing for independence would get an unexpected boost from King George himself. In January of 1776, ships arrived from England carrying the past year's news. The king had announced to Parliament 3 months earlier that he was gathering a huge force to crush the rebellion. On June 7, 1776, Congressional Delegate Richard Henry Lee, a tobacco planter from Virginia, rose to offer the inevitable resolution.
That these United Colonies are free and independent states. That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown.
They wish to make a declaration of independence, not only for the sake of the civilian population who would see this break, would realize what it was for and would support it, but perhaps above all, for foreign opinion, so that other countries could formally note that these colonies had set up their own independent government and therefore, crucially, could negotiate with foreign governments, could contract alliances, and could receive aid.
Congress appointed a 5-man committee to draft a Declaration of Independence. among them Benjamin Franklin and John Adams. But none of the senior members wanted the tedious job of writing it. The document itself, they believed, would be an historical footnote, a technicality. So the task was foisted on the committee's youngest member, 33-year-old Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson didn't want the job either. His mother had recently died, and he had just returned from Virginia after being bedridden for 6 weeks with a migraine headache. Nevertheless, during two hot June days and nights in a second-story rented room, Jefferson bent over his portable writing table and produced the first draft of the most enduring protest document in the history of the free world. Jefferson's words, though magnificent, were not wholly original. He borrowed from his Virginia neighbor, George Mason, who in turn had borrowed from the 17th century British philosopher John Locke. Just weeks earlier, Mason had written in the preamble to the Virginia Constitution that all men by nature are equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights, namely the enjoyment of life and liberty.
There's nothing new in the Declaration of Independence. If its arguments hadn't been familiar and understandable, it wouldn't have been a very powerful document of justification. What you might say was radical about it was, after all, it was an initial formal statement of the first of the modern revolutions against king government and an established legitimate constitution.
All right, we'll take a little break here and come back and finish her up. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450, and 805-6180 to text. We'll be right back. One last blurb here on the Jefferson, the Continental Congress creating the Declaration.
At the age of 32, Jefferson is the second youngest delegate at the Continental Congress. Nevertheless, his reputation as a writer later gets him appointed to the committee drafting a declaration to explain why the colonies wish to become independent of Great Britain.
We now, as modern-day Americans, assume it's like this iconic document. But it wasn't born an iconic document. There was an assumption at the time that America needed to do something to put in writing an explanation of what they were doing, and the Declaration of Independence becomes that document. And Congress does what Congresses do. It says, okay, committee, here's five guys. Go off and figure this out, five guys.
One of the five guys is John Adams of Massachusetts. Though the two men like each other immediately, Adams will be the most volatile friendship in Jefferson's life.
Adams is like this cannon of politics. You know, Adams loves confrontation. He just wants to argue with you and sort of grapple with things. And you can really see those two very different personalities in action.
This is the first of many arguments Adams and Jefferson will have over the course of their long lives.
Thomas Jefferson initially thought that Adams should write the Declaration. Adams said, I can't be the one who writes it. I'm obnoxious and disliked. So it can't come from me. But you are not obnoxious and disliked. Plus, you're a great writer. You should be the one who goes off and writes the draft.
Over the next 17 days, Jefferson stays in his rented Philadelphia room, continuously writing and revising. His document combines the wisdom of the Enlightenment with the rhetorical skills he honed during his 8 years as a lawyer.
We look at that document, and what stands out to us is this idea that all men are created equal. It's the preface. It's the beginning. It's all of the grand statements about humankind. But at the time, in a sense, what was really important about that document is the stuff that we tend to ignore, which is this long list of things that the king has done to the colonies, which is the actual reason why the revolution is happening.
He has obstructed the administration of justice, imposed taxes without our consent, suspended our own legislatures, and quartered armed troops among us.
It can be said, in many respects, that he was an attorney suing on behalf of the colonies against King George III.
I think part of the reason that the opening of the Declaration is timeless is you actually just have to give some credit to Jefferson for being a good writer. He's sort of the poet of the Revolution, or maybe the poet of the founding.
Jefferson essentially writes the creed of America, and America's unusual as a country in that it's not held together by ethnicity, or it's not a particularly homogeneous country. What really holds America together is this mission statement that Jefferson writes, and this is the creed to which Americans subscribe, and that's really what makes Jefferson so important.
All right, so can't beat that, huh? Learn how to write, you can change the world. Got some texts here. I haven't had the text machine in a while. I bet a lot of listeners would pay to subscribe to your show to keep it on the air. I would, Lydia. Thank you, Lydia. It's just getting some recent ones here. Let's see here. Where is Mike when we need him? The synagogue of Satan. Not sure what that means, but. Holy cow, Santa Fe and Minnesota tax, too. Don't know what that means. Interesting. Keep digging, but beware of booby traps. I think that's about the deep state. And Trump wine sells out at Wegmans grocery store after a boycott is called for. I'll drink to that. That's pretty good, huh? And let's see, this one might be. Let's face it, up until now, Mexico is a safe and comfortable place for Mexican nationals to work, live, and raise and educate their children. They have a corrupt government which doesn't address the issues which would create a wonderful country with opportunities for their people. Is that our problem? Yes. But they want you to think that we are their problem. So, I mean, that's right. I mean, you have a failed state. And instead of addressing that, you make the country next door to you the problem, because the country next door to you doesn't get, is not as generous as you want them to be, despite assuming for decades that they need to help meet your needs. The failed countries of Central America are exporting, even worse countries than Mexico are exporting their people into Mexico. Mexico doesn't like it because there's hundreds of thousands of people coming through their country that are even poorer than their own people. And so some of them they send back, others they beat and rape and give electroshocks to. But when we put up a wall to deal with this problem, we are wrongdoers. And the, for example, the law of Arizona is evil, even though Mexico allows almost no freedoms for foreigners. Go figure. 7:59. Kelly O'Connell, have a great day. We'll meet you back in 22 hours. Ciao. You can't.
No way.